This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at ORFM Dunedin.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you in Arabic. My name is Arina Aizal and I'll be your host for the Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation today. In today's episode, we have an interview with Brother Mohammad Amirian, an Iranian PhD scholar at the School of Geography, University of Otago. We begin, though, with a recitation of the Quran by Sheikh Sa'ad Al-Ghamdi, Surah 89, Al-Fajr, Daybreak, verses 1 to 14. According to most scholars, the first part of the passage refers to the first 10 days of Dhul-Hijjah, the last month of the Islamic lunar calendar, when Hajj, pilgrimage, is performed, and it began a few days ago. The second part of the passage mentions the example of past tyrants, how they met the consequences of their evil deed, and note that your Lord is always watchful.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. والفجر وليال عشر والشفع والوتر والليل إذا يسر هل في ذلك قسم لذي حجر ألم تر كيف فعل ربك بعاد إرم ذات العماد التي لم يخلق مثلها في البلاد وثمود الذين جابوا الصخر بالواد وفرعون ذي الأوتاد الذين طغوا في البلاد فأكثروا فيها الفساد فصب عليهم ربك سوط عذاب إن ربك لبالمرصاد.
Translation of the recited verses. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful, by the daybreak and the 10 nights, and the even and the odd, the multiplicity of creation as contrasted with the oneness and uniqueness of the Creator, and by the night when it departs, is all this not a sufficient oath for those who have sins? Have you considered how your Lord dealt with the people of Ad of Iram, the city of lofty pillars, whose like has never been made in any land, and the Thamud who carved their homes into the rocks in the stone valley, and the mighty and powerful Pharaoh? All of them committed excesses in their lands and spread corruption there. So your Lord let a scourge of punishment loose on them. Your Lord is always watchful. We will now have our interview with Brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muhammad.
Assalam, many thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here today. We're very happy to have you to get an Iranian perspective on the US-Israeli war on Iran. This is something that we rarely see in international media. We may have to wait doing that until our next interview, though, because there's so much to learn about yourself first.
Okay, I'm at your service.
Can you please tell us about growing up in Iran?
Oh, beautiful. My birthday was December 10, 1989. I was born, raised, and grew up in a very small town in north of Iran in a family of four. My mom was a teacher and my father was a labor in national factory. And I have a younger sister whose name is Fatima, and she's 4 years younger than me. I would label myself a member of the middle class family in Iran. And for reasons unclear to me, I don't know why, families in Iran that are engaged with education in any level are called cultural family. And I come from cultural family from this perspective. And one thing that all cultural families have in common is the importance of education. So I grew up in an environment that education mattered most, more than anything else. And I remember all the time through elementary school and high school, I was always a top student. And the majority of that came from my mom because she was very finicky and fussy with my grades in education because she was a principal in education office. So she cared too much about my performance in school because she knew where the, the grades were reported. So I couldn't escape from the feedback. And this is, you know, generally, you know, the environment that I grew up in.
So you were in the same school as your mom?
No. You know, in Iran, you know, schools are gendered. You know, it wasn't mixed. But she was a school principal for the schools of girls. And later on, she promoted and went to education office in our city and in our province. So she knew the network. It was like, you know, by the way, our principals, our teachers were her colleagues. So she was very much familiar with the process and everything. Mm.
So it was you and your sister, just the two of you?
Yeah. Really, you know, just you know, in Iran, there was a change in the fertility rate and trends. You know, in 1980 and 1990s, according to the statistics, every family in Iran had 5 to 6 children. But later on, you know, it changed due to all the economic change and inflation and everything. And even, you know, the cultures of families. So in that time, it was fashionable that most of the families had 2 children. And now it has decreased to 1, if they have any, and if they get married.
So you can see the trend.
Of course, there is a trend, yeah.
And you said you were really good in school. What sorts of subjects were you interested in?
There were lots of things that I was interested in, honestly. Math mattered really most to all of the students. So if you wanted to show that you are a nerd and you're a top student, you had to be perfect in math. So that was about math. But the paper and subject that I was specifically very good in, and it somehow differentiated me from other top students, was creative writing. We had a paper called Creative Writing, and it was like this, that in every session our teachers asked to write, something like describe autumn, talk about a memory, describe a desired future. And most of top students struggled with that because it was hard for them to elaborate on their feelings and thoughts. But since poetry was super important in our families, I remember that all of my gifts as a child was books, poetry books. And, you know, in Iranian culture, it's very important. Poetry is very important. And all of my New Year resolution was memorizing poetries of Hafiz, Saadi, Rumi. And my mom was very delighted when I could do this and weave a line or two in my daily conversation. So I had this tendency from that moment to write and, you know, in a poetic way, in a lyrical way. And that was a subject that I was really interested in. The other subject that I really love was sport. And in that period, we had the chance to play football with other students in the yard. And I was very crazy about football. And football, about it, I have a funny story because I told you that my mom was very strict with my performance. So, and the scale in Iran was out of 20. So she only accepted 20, out of 20. And when, you know, I couldn't fulfill this objective and it was 19, she believed that the reason for that is football, that I watched too much football or I played too much football. So my punishment was, you know, depriving from watching football or, you know, playing football with my friends. So maybe one of the reasons that I'm here now is that, you know, law that my mom, you know, enacted against me. So maybe if I was free to watch football as much as I wanted or play as much as I wanted, maybe I was never here. So I had to do perfect at the school. By the way, I loved also football. And we had a group of friends that were talking about European football matches all the time. And we still have it. Yeah.
Do you still play football?
Honestly, I wasn't a good player, honestly, because my physique wasn't that good. But later on, this intention, this interest stayed with me in other forms. And when I went to university, which probably we will speak as follows, I started to write for football, you know. As I told you, you know, in creative writing, I was a good student. So I used that potential in writing for football. I was a writer for the second most visited sport content website in Iran, Taraftari.com. And I have written more than 100 reports for them. And most of those reports were viewed for more than maybe 10,000 times and gave, you know, me positive feedbacks from the readers. But what attracted me about football wasn't just the game. It was never just a game for me. It was an intersection of politics, history, geography, religion, and lots of other things. And this is the window from which I looked at football earlier and later on and now.
I'm glad you could mix your interests and your skills together as well.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about the school system there?
Okay. In Iran, first of all, you know, the schools are gendered. We don't have the opportunity, you know, to have mixed gender schools. Like, we have schools for girls and then schools for boys, okay? In the time that I was a student, we had three different levels. First of all, for 5 years, since seven, we started elementary school. And after that, we go to guidance school, which doesn't exist anymore now. And it was for 3 years. And after that, we go to high school for 4 years. So the entire process is 12 years. And at the end of 12 years, we get a diploma, okay? And then we go to university. But going to university in Iran is a little different than here, because here you directly apply to universities and fields, okay? But it's not like that. You know, in high school, we usually, in the first year of high school, we choose our field. There are typically, generally, three different fields. One of them is mathematics and physics, which in that time was very fashionable for top students. So if your grade was top, probably you go there. And you study mostly math and physics and chemistry and this stuff, okay? And most of the time, these groups of people become engineer, like electronic engineer, mechanical engineer, computer engineer, and this stuff, okay? The second one was experimental science, which is mostly about biology and this stuff. The top students become doctor, dentist, and pharmacist and this stuff, and everything related to biology. And third, human science, they called it, okay? And most of the time, any person related to economy, law, philosophy, sociology, and this stuff, humanities, okay, go there. So that's the bigger picture in that. But beside, you know, beside doing my papers and subjects, I was also very active in marginal activities, I would call it. There were lots of events, lots of plans and programs for students, sporty, cultural, religious, and I was even political, and I was active almost in all of them. Yeah, I was very popular, I would say, in that time. Yeah.
What sorts of clubs did you join?
There were a lot. First of all, we had a music group, especially in guidance school. Our school was very, very considerate in this sense. You know, they considered too much about these stuff. You know, like, for example, we had a music group or chanting group. And, you know, there are competitions in Iran, in city level, province level, and national level. It's very popular. And I remember that I was in the third grade of guidance school. I was around, I would say, 14 or 15, that we got number one in our city, then number one in our province, then we qualified for national competition. And it was held in Tehran, Soviet student force position, which was a great achievement for our school in a very small town. I was also a member of the theater team, and of course, I wasn't good in acting, but, you know, we also shined in province level. In city, we got, you know, the rank one position, but in the province, that there were better teams, so they beat us. And they were also religious, you know, I would say religion-based competitions that I was actively involved in all of them.
I'm glad to know you were very active in school.
Thank you.
I wonder if there was any religious studies as part of school systems?
Yeah. First of all, you know, personally, I grew up in a, I would say, religious environment, but religiosity not in a sense of, I would tell you, in an orthodox way or fundamental way, but religion for me was something spiritual, in a sense that it's, you know, because, you know, that's the way religiosity is elaborated and reflected in Iranian poetry, okay? And since I was very close to Hafiz, Rumi, and Sa'di, and they were also religious people, that was the way I understood religion. It was very inclusive. For example, a line that I can remember at the moment from Hafiz says that everyone is looking for beloved, either the sober one or the drunk one, and everywhere is the house of God, either the mosque or the synagogue. So that was the way I understood religion in that time. We had actively papers and subjects about religion, and they were teaching us about the ethics of religion, about the do's and don'ts, and how to be a good Muslim, okay, in a school, elementary guidance and high school then. And there were also competitions in, you know, in city level, as I told you, province level and national level. As far as I remember, there were three brands. The first one was memorizing Quran, or hefs, as you call it. The second one was reading Quran or Qiraat, probably, you know, of course, in a rhythmic and nice way. And the third one was tafsir, or analyzing Quran, okay? And I remember that when I was in the first grade of high school, I got rank one in Iran in the analyzing of Quran, and that was a very big achievement for our family and our city. And I remember when I came back from the lovely city of Isfahan, because a national competition was held in Isfahan, all the principals came to our house, and they didn't believe that a student from our city can have such an achievement when we have cities like Tehran, Shiraz, Mashhad, or Isfahan, which are metropolises, okay? And that was one of the most memorable achievements that I remember in that time.
Yeah. You mentioned that your city is quite small. So where were you born and where were you grow up?
It was in Gurgan, a city in north of Iran. Yeah, that's a north and mid-sized city in Iran.
Mm-hmm. And you grew up there the whole time?
Yeah. Of course, at the age of 18, I went to Tehran because of university. And, because in Iran, everything is very centralized. All the equipment, all the infrastructures, top universities, top industries are in Tehran. Going to Tehran is like a qualification. And yeah, at the age of 18, I went to Tehran University of Art to get my bachelor. And then after that, master, and then working. So I would say after 18, I was kind of living in Tehran.
Hmm. And let's talk about your studies after high school. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me about your undergraduate?
Yeah, 100%. It was a milestone in my life, in a sense that, before that, I was living in an isolated environment, I would say. Just family, going to school, studying and everything. And all of a sudden, going to Tehran was like a living a river and going to ocean. So specifically the university that I attended, Tehran University of Art, because we had a lovely campus in which on one side it was us, architecture students and urban planning students. I got qualified for urban planning engineering for bachelor, okay? And the other building was music, the other one was cinema, the other one was sculptures, okay? So you could see all artists all over, the campus, and I was kind of like Alice in Wonderland, in especially first 2 years, because, music wasn't that much popular in our cities in that time. And for example, if you covered the case of a violin or a guitar, it was kind of weird for people that, what are you doing? Who are you? Okay. But then from this environment, I went to a place in which you could see everyone playing violin, playing guitar on the sidewalk, in the cafeteria and everywhere. And that was a revolutionary moment in my life. And something very, very interesting was that lots of musicians that I dreamed to see them were the lecturers, were the associate professor in that university, lots of painters, lots of movie makers, and we easily could see them in the campus, okay? So those 4 years was exceptional to me. I lived in a dormitory inside the campus, and the dormitories inside Iran is not like here, because here students have privacy. It's just one student for one room. But in Iran, it wasn't like that. So we lived in a room with three other students. So we didn't have that much privacy, but we had lots of other good things. I remember one of my friends used to play classical violin. The other used to play piano. The other one used to play tar, which was an Iranian musical instrument. So you could learn a lot of things. And those 4 years took me to places that, mentally, that I could never go, in a sense that I got familiar with lots of movie makers, with lots of musicians, with lots of things that probably if I was in other universities, I would never encounter. Probably I would never encounter with, meaningful movie makers like Kiarostami, with musicians like Bach and all of this stuff. And I get all of them from that university.
Mm.
Yeah.
And how was your course?
I didn't like it that much. Because I remember for the first day when we went there, they gave us some very big sheets. They called it Eschenbach. It's a German word. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Sheets which are very long, like 70 to 50. And they asked us to make some parallel lines. And I was kind of shocked. What is this? I'm an engineer. I want to talk about, mass and physics and this stuff. So you ask us to make some lines, some parallel lines. So I couldn't love it a lot initially, but then things changed and some people came to my path, specifically in master, that changed the direction of my academy. And one of the reasons that I'm here is them, because we had to pass lots of papers and some of them wasn't that much interesting. And yeah, you know, in terms of, you know, academic performance, I wasn't the top student in bachelor, but later on things changed.
Mm, but you still had a good time
while
you were there.
Of course, I had a super, super nice time, you know, having furry concerts all the time, musicians all over the place. So, yeah.
Did you do your master's at the same university?
No, no. You know, there are lots of public universities in Tehran, okay? And I went to a better university. It's called Tarbiyat Mudarris University. And that's a university that has only graduate students, no bachelor, only master and PhD. And I remember that my rank, because again, I have to tell you again that how we get to university. You know, there is a nationwide entrance exam, okay? For example, for bachelor, after getting our diploma at the last year of high school, okay, there is a nationwide entrance exam. All of the students at the same time compete together in a 4 years test, okay? And there are questions from everything, from literature, language, I don't know, theology, I don't know, Arabic language, even math, physics, chemistry, everything, okay? Of course, the questions differ from according to the branch that you are, physics, mathematics or physics, experimental science or human science, I mentioned earlier, okay? And then again for master, okay? All the students who want to attend to urban planning, master of urban planning, okay, they have to compete together. And I remember that my rank was 5 out of around 2,000 or 3,000 students. So that helped me to go to that university. Tarbiyat Mudarris University wasn't that fun. It was very serious. And I didn't like the vibe in there because in art university, the people were very colorful, you know, just very informal. You know, you could see people just playing guitar and all of this stuff. So it was very informal and very cool. But in Mudarris University, it was very serious, like people dressed in suits and jackets, you know, having bags. But that was the moment that I fell in love with my major. Because prior to that, I couldn't find where I can situate myself in the field, okay?
So what was your major?
It was urban planning, okay? But in bachelor, we mostly had papers about technical things like transportation, housing, things that didn't satisfy me. I was very interested in sociology aspect of that. And in master, I find this connection that how I can be a sociologist, but at the same time being an urban planner, focusing on young people, focusing on people, focusing on public spaces is where I could connect the limits of my major with my intentions, you know?
Mm.
And the other thing that I found is that people are very important also. Some people came in my path, specifically my master supervisor, Dr. Rafiyan, who I really appreciate and love. And he made me fall in love with this major. And now even the project that I've done at the University of Otago, I'm building on that. So, yeah.
So did you have a thesis for your master's?
Yeah, we have, even in bachelor, yeah.
Can you tell me about that thesis?
Yeah, you know, there is a, you know, I told you that, you know, my main field of interest in planning is public spaces and how, because public spaces where so many things happen at the same time. At the same time, there is power, there are policies, there is government, there is resistance, there is culture. All of them happen at the same time. So one of the things that draw my attention was there is a historical square, there is a historical zone in Tehran, in the center of Tehran, okay, which is located in the center of Tehran. On one side, we have the traditional bazaar of Tehran. On the other side, we have the palace that Qajar, the kings 200 years ago, lived there. On the other side, we have two main monumental squares, and it's a very important site. And municipality, Tehran City Council, had decided to make it pedestrian. So what I did was, and according to some statistics, every day around 100,000 people visit that site inside Tehran. And, you know, the Grand Bazaar serves in national level. They send shipments to all over Iran. So that's a very interesting side. You know, as you can see, we have politics, we have economy, we have culture and history together. So I studied that zone in a sense that how people experience it, what are the barriers, how we can make it better and all of this stuff. And that was my main focus.
And now you're doing a PhD at the University of Otago. So
yeah.
Can you tell me how you got here? Was it with a scholarship?
Yeah. It was with full doctoral scholarship. And I had to wait for that. Let me tell you that, you know, if there wasn't COVID, probably I had started at 2020 because I got my admission and a scholarship that time. And then all of a sudden, I mean, on the months that they were going to announce my scholarship report, COVID happened. And they sent me an email that we have to stop everything. And that was a very terrible time. I think I had to wait for 3 years. But by that, by the way, that was also a blessing. You know, I believe that whatever happens is nice from God, and God's plan is always better than us. So it gave me the opportunity to work for Tehran City Council for 3 years, which was a very good experience for me in there. But then, yeah, when the borders were open again, I came here and I started my PhD. Again, my focus is on young people and public spaces, but this time in a bigger picture, because for me, the tension between modernity and traditionality in Iran has always been a concern, like how these two streams collide together and how interact together. Because on one side, young people in Iran, inspired by global trends and social media, have tendencies that can be labeled as westernized, bars, clubs, stuff, you know, fashion. And on the other side, there is a traditional religious cohort in society that the government represent them. So I wanted to see how these two streams interact to each other. And thanks to University of Otago, they gave me a scholarship so I could elaborately work on that in the last 3 years.
So you've been here for 3 years?
I arrived here on exactly on April 7, 2023.
How long do you have to go?
I've been here for like 3 years, and I just got my post-study work visa, so probably I will be here for another 3 years, and I hope that I can stay here for the rest of my life, because New Zealand has all the dimensions that I want from life. I'm so blessed and honored to live here. Specifically, Dunedin is a very lovely city. It's a little cold, but I love the vibe. I love the Iranian community here, and I love the people here, and the nature is super amazing.
So you also published like articles around, in academic journals, yeah, about this. Can you tell us more?
Again, you know, it's so funny because when some time ago I was looking at the titles of papers that I have published, okay? And one thing that I found is that, I'm an urban planner, and technically it should have urban planning stuff inside the paper. But the term social, the word social is in the title of, I would say, half of my paper. So social capital, socioeconomic impact of pedestrian projects. So this shows that how much bias I am toward this, you know, social aspect of urban life. So the first paper that I published was, if I'm not wrong, was about how urban planners can increase social interaction within public spaces through design and policy. The second one was, you know, I was trying to design a model based on right to city discourse, which is, you know, published in sociology by Henry Leffer and his friends, you know, that talks about how some people are marginalized, like, let's say, minorities, minority religion, religious minorities, ethnical minorities, or young people, or any group, I don't know, people of colors and whatever, even immigrants, okay? So how we can give them more voice, okay? And how this process can be modeled, you know? This was another paper that I worked on. The other paper that I can remember at the moment was on understanding the relationship between the quality of life and social capital, and why social capital is much more important. Because there were some neighborhoods in Tehran that were very renowned, you know, they were very beautifully structured and built, but you couldn't get that sense of belonging to there, okay? So from my perspective, because the common idea in quality of life is that if you live in a good environment, like the buildings are beautiful, the roads are clean, you know, there are lots of green space, okay, automatically there is a behavioral aspect, like you feel you're responsible for the community. And this makes a sense of belonging and togetherness. But I noticed in some parts of Tehran, despite the environment was very beautiful physically, there wasn't such a sense of belonging and togetherness. The people don't talk to each other, they don't know each other. And that was when I inserted the idea of social capital. And I showed that there is no automatic relationship between cognitive, you know, quality of life and behavior level. It's not like if you live in a good environment, you automatically feel responsible. There should be bonds, there should be ties between the people. And the length of residency, I don't know, the unity of people, the public spaces, again, are very important to bring people together and lead to a higher quality of life.
And while you were at Otago, you also attended academic conferences,
yeah,
to present those papers.
There were two conferences that I attended. The second one was really nice. For the first, you know, the first one was held in Wellington. That was SWAC, State of Australasian Conferences, something like that. And it was in 2023 when I was 6 months through my PhD, so I didn't have that much experience. It was very strange to me, like, what am I doing here? What are these people? Because I was very perplexed with my own research in that stage. As I told you, I was just 6 months through that. But it was a nice one. I made a good network. I familiarized myself with the academic stage, and I presented my research there. But the second one in Australia was fabulous because we run a session. We organized a session, and our session, I would say, was maybe the best one because number of presentation was higher than all other sessions. I remember probably 7 sessions. That was also a nice opportunity for me to manage a session, you know, all on my own, because by the way, there are language barriers, you know, and language is not just a set of words, it's confidence, it's, you know, it's the way you feel, it's all of these things. So all of these students, or most of them, were native students from Australia or New Zealand, so I could manage it, and that was really nice. I also presented a nice paper, and that was the last session of the last day of the conference. So despite lots of students and lecturers departed because of travel, I remember that most of other people stayed to see our session, and the house was full. And it was held in Newcastle University. And I didn't know that there is also a Newcastle in Australia. Initially, I was like, oh, I have to go to UK to attend the conference. Yeah. But that was a very, very nice, memorable moment for me.
I'm glad you had that experience.
Yeah.
Before coming to New Zealand, you worked for more than 10 years as a policy analyst and also a policy advisor in Tehran and Iran.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned this a bit while you were waiting for
visa.
COVID.
Yeah.
But before talking about your work experience, it would be good if you share a bit about the city, Tehran,
okay.
The population, the size.
Tehran. Tehran is probably the biggest city in Iran. Of course, in terms of the exact number of population, there are some controversy in a sense that some people live inside the city, some people live outside the city but come to city through the day because of work. So I can say that more than 10 million people live in Tehran. It's a very big city, and that's very normal if you get stuck in traffic for 4 hours a day. I remember when I was a master's student, our dormitory was in north of Tehran and my workplace was in center of that. And every day I had to travel from my dormitory to work for 2 hours, from home to work and 2 hours back. And, you know, the rhythm of life is very fast. It's like a competition. You have unlimited opportunities for, you know, if you're a cafe person, you know, there are thousands and thousands of cafes. There are thousands and thousands of restaurants, and there are lots of things in there. But at the same time, it has the stink of big cities, because one of the things that I never loved in Tehran was the difference between the socioeconomic gap in south and north of Tehran, because Tehran can be divided to three parts: affluent north, less privileged south, and I would say medium middle. So there is a long street, Valley Asr Street, which runs from the south of Tehran and goes to the north of Tehran. It's 17 kilometers long. So when you drive in this street, it's like you're traveling in time, not just location, like from very poor countries in 1950 to the richest country in 2026. So then you ask yourself, like, these are the same people living in the same city. Why there is such a big gap? But I love that city, I would say. I love, despite all of the problems that it has, you know, because probably, you know, I'm a communicative and social person. I'm an easygoing person. I love to get together with people. And that's a little hard in Tehran because people come from different backgrounds and they're very reticent and conservative in a sense that they don't want to share too much about themselves. So it's quite often that you live in Tehran for 10 years in an apartment and you don't know your neighbor and he doesn't know you. But this is horse of a different color in smaller towns like the one that I grew up, because everybody know each other. And the moment that you get out of your house to go to the supermarket, which is 50 meters away, you see maybe 10 people. Mm-hmm. And you have to say to them, hi, hello, and what's up, you know, how's it going, you know, did you see the football game? Okay. So from that background, coming to Tehran was a little shocking. But I loved all the things that Tehran gave to me, because Tehran kind of made me into the person that I am now, despite all of its hardships and difficulties, even both at university and the work.
What was it like working there?
I would say, you know, I cannot give you just one answer because, you know, look, I was working for Tehran Municipality. And let me tell you something. Tehran Municipality is Then the municipality city council, in fact, what they call it here, city council, okay? But in Iran, they call it municipality because city council is another organization that's elected chancellors, you know, by the vote of people. So that's city council. But so in order to avoid confusion, I say Tehran City Council. Tehran City Council is a very huge organization in which 50,000 people work, okay? So I would say office to office, organization to organization, section to section, it's different. So I cannot tell you that's super enjoyable. There were teams in which there was a heavy load of work, you know, and people were angry because, you know, that city council and government has a stature, you know, regulatory, you know, position. So people come for subdivision or consent. And when we say no, you know, they get very angry. They are like, oh, you are limiting us. You know, why you don't allow us? So there were some tense days. But at the same time, you know, the team were very, very, very supportive to each other. And I learned so much from them. And I still am in contact with them, of course, before the internet blockade in Iran. Okay. So specifically the team that we went there, because it was a very competitive competition, we went there by giving again a nationwide test, which was very hard. And all of the students that went there in that period together, they were master or PhD of urban planning or architecture or, you know, civil engineering. And except me, the rest of them were very top students and brilliant minds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And while studying at Otago, you also worked part-time.
I work for different sections, you know, sometimes relevant, sometimes irrelevant, but even the most irrelevant ones taught me lots of things. I was an academic tutor for the last 2 years, yeah, and I had tutorials in geography, in sociology, in criminology, and this semester history, which was really lovely because I really love to get together with people, especially younger people, and teach them because teaching for me is a passion. It's not just a job. I had planned for every session, I would say. And one thing that I really loved is that because, you know, most of the students at this age are members of Generation Z. And they are all the time with their cell phone, smartphones, and TikTok, Instagram, and this stuff. So it's very hard for them to focus on long-term, one-sided lectures. So I try to make it interactive and fun for them. So, yeah, that's something that I really loved. And the level of attendance of the students in my classes also show that they are enjoying the class because I avoid making formal, structured, hierarchical, you know, classes and try to make it as much as interactive and participatory. I also worked for a short period of time as a restaurant manager in Georgia Strait. That was a Mexican one, Taco Vida. And that period was also very nice because, you know, it wasn't a big restaurant. I had to do all the tasks on my own, from preparation to cooking to cleaning to managing and everything, online customers. And one thing that I really loved again was customer services. When people come to a restaurant, when you talk to them, when, you know, maybe that's the, I'm very egoistic probably, but that's the positive aspect of having a multifaceted, you know, personality, because there's at least a little thing about anything that I know from countries. And so when someone comes, I'm like, oh, where are you from? And he says, for example, Mexico. I say, oh, Aztec civilization. And then the conversation starts. Oh, where are you from? For example, London. So which football club do you love in London? West Ham. So yeah, the conversation goes on. So in this way, I could get together with people. And one thing that I found there was that communication is really important. It's really important. People want to be heard. People want to be seen. And they just don't come for food. They come for an experience. And honesty is also very important. I can remember a very good memory from that time. I remember, you know, we usually close by 10. And we started closing by 9, like cooling down, you know, cleaning. And I remember one night, a couple from Wales, the country next to UK, they were very, very well-dressed and generous, came to the restaurant and asked for burrito. And I told them, hey, guys, look, you know, we are running late, you know, we are out of lots of ingredients. And the concept of Mexican food is different flavors, several ingredients, okay? If there are 10 ingredients in burrito, we run out of 5 of them. So this is not maybe the best burrito that you can get. But they said, no problem. We want it. And then I started cooking. And when I was cooking, I was like, oh, Mohammed, this is not a good one. I went back to them and said, hey, guys, you know, I'm okay to be here. Don't think that I want to leave and go sleep, okay? But it's not the perfect burrito. They said, no problem. We want it. And then I cooked it for them. And they were very happy. Gave me $20 tip. Wrote a very positive feedback. But these are not the things that I'm proud of. One thing that I genuinely learned is that people prefer honesty over perfection. So if you're honest with them, they will be much happier than anything else.
Mm. And I'm glad with your personality, you get to work with people as well in many ways.
Yeah, 100%.
Mm. Let's talk about your life.
Unfortunately, my mom passed away 2 years ago. And that was very, very sorrowful moment for me because I was very attached and connected emotionally to my mom.
Was she in Iran?
She was in Iran in that time. And it was a very bad day. I remember it exactly. It was early in the morning here because it happened late at night in Iran, 2 or 3 a.m., because of a heart attack. And then a relative shared it online. And my sister was sleeping. She didn't know because she lived in other places in that night. And then when I saw it on social media, I was like, what is this? And God knows how many times I refreshed. Maybe something changed in the caption or photo. But it was the same, my mom's photo with a short caption, rest in peace. And my sister also lives in Iran with my father. But here we have a super lovely Iranian community, which I really love them. I mean, something that I found here is that Iranian people, specifically in the city of Dunedin, are like a family. So supportive, so warm, just like sister and brother. And something that's something unimaginable before coming here. Because, you know, Dunedin is 15,000 kilometers away from Iran. Everyone was talking about homesickness and all of this stuff. But let me confess that I never felt homesick for 1 second here. Because the very first time, the very first moment that I arrived in Dunedin, an Iranian person, Payam, who is now in Auckland with his family, gave me a ride and came and picked me. And it was, I exactly remember, it was Easter. And I didn't know what's Easter and that on Easter, you know, the supermarkets are closed. And when he arrived me to my flat, he gave me a bag full of food. And that was the moment that I realized, where is Dunedin? And what does it mean to be Iranian for the Iranian community here? We have monthly gathering together, watching movies, analyzing the movie. We have weekly gathering. You know, we have very, very warm and lovely and supportive youth club, I would say. You know, going to gym together, playing together, partying together. So my life in Dunedin was amazing, I would say. I really love it. And at the same time, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that because of job, I have to leave it. And then I cannot find this community anywhere else because so many people say this.
Mm. Is there an established Iranian club here?
Not a formal one. Or maybe there, if there is formal, I'm not aware about it. Probably there are some. And some of them are doing. But, you know, our culture is about informality. You know, just sending a text, you know, to each other. And, hey, Mohammed, are you down for a coffee? Yeah, come to my place, you know. Hey, guys, are you down for a badminton together, you know, this evening? Yes, let's go, okay. Everything is just fixed like this.
What was your first impression of Dunedin, the city?
First of all, I have lived in 3 different cities. Let me tell you something surprising. Dunedin is the only city that I can call it my city. And for reasons still unclear to me, I love this city. Maybe first of all, what I love about this city is the warmth of people. Some very, very small mundane things like having a short, Kia ora, have a good day. Hey, how are you? Nice day. Good morning. These are the things that make my life, okay? Some of my friends complain about the smallness of the city and that there isn't big shopping malls, big skyscrapers, and like international events like those in Melbourne and Sydney, okay? And even they make fun of Dunedin, they say, this is a retirement city. But I never found it to be a retirement city. This city has everything that I want. You know, in your walking distance, you can go to Sandkill, Saint-Clair, and enjoy the beautiful beach. You know, there are lots of beaches all around the city. The people are also super nice. You know, I'm sure that you, as a woman, you never feel insecure in this city, even if you get out late at night, okay? But in big cities, no matter where, Iran or New Zealand, I'm not sure if you have these qualities, okay? So in Dunedin, a part of my personality that hardly could manifest itself in Tehran could show itself, and that's a warm, friendly, childhood, you know, childish and playful personality that you can talk to people, you can smile at them, you can put away that serious mask that you have to show in big cities like Tehran, because in Tehran, life is like a competition. You have to do it faster, more, make more money, bigger car, bigger house, better life, okay? It's like a competition. But here you can have pause and reflection. And that's what I love about this city. There is a moment when you are driving from airport to the city that, you know, the road is hilly, and all of a sudden you see the city landscape. I love that moment.
And since you're in urban planning, what do you think about Dunedin in that sense?
Beautiful. Of course, I love to keep this conversation away from technical stuff, but I think some good things are happening, specifically in George Street. You know, you can see that when they decided to make it pedestrian, of course, that was a costly project, okay? But since then, we have lots of events in that, like the markets. I don't know if you were there. And you could see that lots of people came there. So I think it's very important to have that sense of community and belonging together. And I would encourage the city council to have the same project specifically in South Dunedin, because in South you have lots of potentials, but you don't get that sense of belonging, you know, the way you have in center and north. So that's something that I can mention.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you didn't feel homesick, but were there any other challenges that you experienced adjusting to a new society?
There were some cultural things, I would say. Something that I didn't like was that, you know, some of my international friends didn't get my jokes, my sense of humor, because imagine it like that, you know, exaggeration is one of the way, intentional exaggeration, okay, is a way that we usually joke about ourselves. And for example, I submitted my doctoral thesis last week, okay? And then I come and tell my friends that, oh, I'm now the doctor, you know, you have to respect me. I'm a very nozzle. So it's very obvious that I'm joking, but I don't know why they don't get it. Like, they think that I do mean it. And then they say, oh, Muhammad, stay humble. And it really makes me crazy. Like, oh, guys, how don't you understand that I'm joking? You know, I'm trying to make fun of myself. So you should laugh at it. So these things make it a little hard to be international.
I've heard that you are usually funnier in your own culture.
100%, that's right. You know, and there are lots of opportunities that you lose to be funny in the second language, because you don't know exactly if you say this, it's funny or silly. So you have to be quiet, which is very bad. And the other point is that, by the way, I came here when I was 33. So my personality was formed, you know, and it's different when someone comes here at the age of 16, okay? Sometimes they are talking about something that I don't know what's that. What's that at all? Because we live in different worlds. You know what I say? For example, I've never watched a Netflix serial. Okay. And that's quite normal for me. But I have watched the stuff that they haven't. So finding that common ground is a little hard because experiences are a little different. And by the way, when I talk to you, we should talk about something. Something that you understand, I understand, you like, I like. Okay. It's not like a lecture. But yeah, I love it after all. I think it's cool.
And it takes a while to find that common ground.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Have you visited other places in New Zealand?
Of course. I have been to Wellington. I have been to Christchurch. I have been to, I would say, the most beautiful place I have ever been, Queenstown. I love Queenstown very much, specifically when we went to Milford Sound. And that was amazing. That was amazing. Because one of the things, I remember the good thing. One of the things that I don't like about Dunedin and New Zealand is nightlife. Because life in Tehran started at 8 p.m. Because I told you, at 5, you know, we are retired by work. Then it takes like 2 hours to get home. And then taking a bus and getting fresh, so people come out, you know, at 8. And there are street music, street theater, street food, cafes, restaurants, shopping malls. So the city is on fire until 12 or 1 a.m., okay? And that's part of our life, like going, driving with our friends at night, going to restaurant, coffee shops and all of this stuff. But here, the life dies at 5 or 6, so you don't see any person in the street. So that was my first question, like what people do at 8 or 9, you know? At home, isn't it boring for them? So something that Queenstown had over here was nightlife, specifically in the center of city, CBD. There are lots of good restaurants, lots of good bakeries and coffee shops, and it's very international. So people get out. And you have a lake on the other side. So I really love Queenstown. It's so beautiful, however, very expensive at the same time. So when I was telling to my friends, I would love to work in Queenstown if I can't work in Dunedin. They were saying, oh, Muhammad, it's very expensive. Don't forget that. Christchurch didn't get me the way that Dunedin and Queenstown got me. Maybe because it was very plain. And I love the hilly aspect of the Dunedin. My place at the moment is above the hill, so from my window I can see the landscape of city, so that's amazing every time that I look at it. And Wellington was also nice, but it was very windy, like the wind was taking you all the time. So I'm very happy that I'm heavy, but I think that people who are not as heavy as me might have some trouble, you know, staying on the ground when it's windy.
Mm. I'm glad you had that experience of visiting other cities as well. You're now on the post-study work visa. What are your future plans?
Future plan, beautiful. First of all, I should confess that I don't think that in life we are that much agentive, in a sense that I can exactly tell you what I'm going to do. I think, you know, there is a joke. There is a joke in Iran. Of course, it's not funny, honestly, even in Persian language. But they say someone goes to and offers someone to get married. And then his friend asks him, so how do you see? He says, 50% from my perspective, that's fine. But the problem is your 50% is not important. The other 50% matters most, okay? Because it's normal that you're okay, but the other person must be okay with you. So that's again, you know, if I could exactly decide my future, I wanted to be a lecturer or an academic person in University of Otago, because teaching and research is something that deeply satisfies me. But there aren't that many positions at the moment in the university. And there are lots of competitions because I'm not the only person. I think just in our university, we have more than 10 PhD students. All of them are very nice and top. So based on my background, because I was in council, technically I should be in a city council or regional or district council in New Zealand. And I would be very happy if I can serve this community. I'm applying at the moment and getting interviews, trying to find ways to serve this community, because this country has given me more than I deserved, I think.
And thank you so much, Brother Mohammed, for being here today. And we enjoyed learning more about you. Next time, we will learn more about your perspective on the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. So stay tuned. Thank you.
Thank you. Many thanks for having me, and all the best.
Now, we listen to an Islamic song about Hajj, pilgrimage to Mecca, from Islamic Nasheed.
Distance, I see the light, a journey of faith, a heart so bright. I long to stand where the angels fly, at the house of Allah. I close my eyes and cry, Hajj, oh Hajj, my heart yearns for you, to walk around. The call of the Adhan echoes in my soul. It pulls me closer, makes me whole. Through every step, my heart feels alive. In your mercy, O Allah, I long to arrive. Hajj, O Hajj, my heart yearns for you. As the sun sets low, I make my cries. Ya Allah, accept me, forgive my sin. I long for your mercy to let me in. Hajj, oh Hajj, my heart yearns for you. To walk around the Kaaba, my soul feels so true. I dream of your law. At the Kaaba, my heart finds peace. In your presence, all burdens cease. I wait for the day when I'll be there, standing with love in your care.
presence, all burdens cease. I'll wait for the day when I'll be there, standing with love in your care.
That is the end of our program today. Thank you for your time. Special thank you to ORFM for facilitating the production of this program. I should add that the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Otago Muslim Chaplaincy as such. If you have any questions, please email muslimchaplaincy@otago.ac.nz. We hope to see you next time, inshallah, God willing. Assalamualaikum.
You've been listening to Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at OARFM Dunedin.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.